So there's a recording in progress. Everybody knows we're being recorded, apparently. And thank you all for joining us for this year's installment of the Supreme Court in Bankruptcy Case Review. With us is Tom Schreiner from the Foley firm. And to Tom's left, Frank DeCastri from the Reinhardt firm.
Considerably to my left.
Well, I don't know about that.
He's a creditor's lawyer, so maybe not.
To talk to us about what the Supreme Court did last year by way of interpreting the bankruptcy code, and to maybe share some insights on what's on the Supreme Court's plate as to bankruptcy for the 2023 term. And maybe if from skimming the outline, maybe if time remains, a little bit about a case coming out of this court that worked its way through the Seventh Circuit and is now, I guess, cert pending in the Supreme Court. So with that, gentlemen.
You want to say something? Frank and I didn't get a chance to talk this morning beforehand, but he made the comment, was this actually the same thing that struck me? There have been years when we've struggled to find anything to talk about in terms of what the Supreme Court had done or was going to do in bankruptcy. But for those of you who follow the court a little bit, wholly aside from bankruptcy, they're not that busy. I mean, they've got 60, 70 cases, all they do in a year. And there are times, this being one of them, where it seems like they're looking for something to do. And guess what comes up? Well, these are interesting cases. This is bankruptcy. I don't know anything about that. Let's set down the law. And so the last couple of years, we've had several. And that's fun. It gives us something to talk about. And the one thing you will note in these materials, I think, we'll point it out if you don't, is that by long tradition, the assignment to write bankruptcy opinions for the Supreme Court goes to the low justice on the totem pole. So this year we get one by Barrett and two by Jackson. It isn't something that they're all fighting to get at.
But just to be clear, right, you're not proposing that the cert pool memo says, here's something you guys don't know anything about, you should grant cert in this.
Well, maybe the clerks in the cert pool don't know anything about it either, so they don't need to say it. So go ahead.
Yeah, so quick overview of what we have today. The first couple cases, Bartenwerfer versus Buckley, and the Moac Mall Holdings case, Mall of America case. Those we discussed, if you've been attending this with any frequency, last year. And so this year, what we have to discuss really is the decisions of the court on those. Then there was a third case decided in the last term. That's the Lac de Flambeau case that was actually, I believe that petition was granted, the briefing occurred, argument and all of that, and the decision was issued after our presentation last year. So that one's totally new. And then we have probably the most significant case pending before the Supreme Court this year. That's the Purdue Pharma case involving third-party releases, which is getting lots of attention. Over 20 amicus briefs filed in that case. Including somewhat humorously by debtors in other cases that have just recently confirmed very large, significant plans with third-party releases in them, like the Boy Scouts of America. And then a couple of cases towards the end that where the petitions were just granted. And so the merits briefing isn't even in on those yet. But we thought it made sense to at least address them. Those will be things we can look forward to next year. And then lastly, as Judge Helfinger mentioned, a case that was recently issued by the Seventh Circuit and petition for cert is pending. Last year, you got a case that ironically I had before the Seventh Circuit, and this year you get one where Tom is involved. So bringing it to you real time, as always. Barton-Werfer versus Buckley. You may remember this. This is a case about discharge under 523A2A. This is no discharge of an individual debtor from any debt for money, property, services, or an extension, renewal, or refinancing of credit to the extent that it, the debt is obtained by false pretenses, false representation, or actual fraud. And what happened here, this is a case that, determines whether, even by no fault of the debtor's own, whether a debt based in fraud can nevertheless be held non-dischargeable because the fraud gets imputed to the debtor in some way, typically by state law. This involved the purchase of a home in San Francisco, and the sellers had formed a partnership under California law, which meant, of course, that each became the agent of the other, shared assets and liabilities, and including liabilities for torts. And in California, I think it's probably the case in most states, as long as one partner acts with the requisite fraudulent intent, then the and a third party relies on that to its detriment, then the fraud can be imputed to the other partner without regard to their own fraudulent intent or knowledge. So there was a 19-day jury trial in this case, and they found that, and this all had to do with what seems like a fairly run-of-the-mill failure to disclose information in connection with the sale of a home, and they found the sellers liable. They had failed to disclose something or misrepresented something.
And this is all in the state court, right?
Yes, yeah. This is all in state court. And so then following that judgment, the sellers decide they're both going to file for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And the bankruptcy court found the debts were non-dischargeable, concluding that because David, the husband, had committed actual fraud, that his fraud was imputed to Kate, the wife, because there was this agency relationship. The bankruptcy appellate panel saw it a little bit differently. They affirmed as to David's debt, but vacated and remanded as to Kate's. They didn't think it was right that Kate should be held responsible. And so they said Kate's debt was dischargeable unless she, quote, knew or had reason to know of the husband's fraud. So it went back. There was a trial solely on that issue.
Didn't take 19 days this time?
Apparently not. I would guess not. It was held that Kate's debt was dischargeable, and then the BAP affirmed when it went back up again.
They better.
Then the Ninth Circuit actually reversed. Around and around we go. Found that the BAP had and the bankruptcy court had applied the incorrect legal standard. The fraud does get imputed to, in this case, the wife, the partner. The debt.
And the bankruptcy court applied the wrong standard because it had been ordered to do so by the BAP, right?
By the bankruptcy judges.
Yeah. Well, so what? They're probably from Idaho or somewhere, right? Or
applying the universal unfortunate but honest debtor principle.
Yes, there you go. So then Kate, the wife, seeks writ of certiorari, invoking a circuit conflict over this new or should have known rule. So she argues that, the honest but unfortunate debtor, bankruptcy code offers a fresh start. The way that this section is drafted, which he argues is that it really focuses on the debtor, the only debtor that, or individual that could have obtained assets by fraud. It really has to refer back to the debtor. And then they point to other subsections of Section 523, it's obviously a passive voice kind of statute. But they argue that, you know, look, this really, it has to be the debtor. The fact that it's passive and says obtained by fraud, I take you back to the language again. Of course, the statute focuses on the debt. So it's got to be a debt for money, property, services. And then it says to the extent that that debt is obtained by false pretenses or actual fraud. So it doesn't really focus on the actor. It focuses on the type of debt that it is. But nevertheless, Kate argues that that passive voice doesn't render the actor irrelevant. There's other textual and contextual evidence that shows that only individual debtors can commit fraud. The modern code is debtor friendly, in case you didn't know. There's some discussion about a case called Strang.
Important case.
An important case because...
About 150 years old, right?
At the time, the statute said it actually specifically referred to fraud of the bankrupt. And the Supreme Court in that case nevertheless found that partner of the debtor was that the fraud was imputed to that person, and therefore the debt was non-dischargeable.
Showing the 19th century judges' receptiveness to debtors.
Yes, very receptive. In fact, there's a footnote there on page 4 about a Seventh Circuit case that has some, you know, quite remarkable language about debtors being sent to prison and so on.
I read about that in Dickens.
You did? Buckley comes back. This is the plaintiff in the suit and says, no, it's as the statute reads, it focuses on the debt, not the actor. And the statute only asks whether you have money or property obtained by actual fraud and whether the debtor's liability arises from that. Of course, they toot the Strang horn and say that case supports their view of it. And they point out what they think is that it really reflects sound policy, that what's happening here is you're really deferring to state policy judgments about the circumstances under which a person should be found liable for the fraud of another. There were some friend of the court briefs that were filed by some judges.
Not as many as in Purdue Pharma.
Not as many as Purdue Pharma. Ultimately, the court, it's Justice Barrett who writes the decision. And she concludes, as I think, although we don't tend to predict what happens in these cases.
Right. We did predict.
We essentially predicted written in the passive voice, the statute turns on how the money was obtained, not on who committed the fraud to obtain it. The statute focuses on the event that occurs without reference to the actor.
We pay attention to the text in here, don't we? Isn't that how we do that?
Yes. She came away with this kind of colorful quote, the passive voice does not hide the relevant actor in plain sight, it pulls the actor off the stage. She points out that the common law of fraud has long maintained that fraud liability is not limited to the wrongdoer, principals being liable for the frauds of their agents, individuals being liable for the frauds of their partners within the scope of the partnership, and so on. She too cites the Strang case and notes that even when the statute had the language fraud of the bankrupt, they still found that the fraud would be imputed to the partner. An interesting comment about the fresh start. We've seen several of these comments come out of the Supreme Court in recent years. There was another one by Justice Kagan. I want to say it was in the Technology decision. where they seem to be pushing back a little bit on these debtor-friendly concepts. She says the fresh start policy of the bankruptcy code does not mean the code is focused on the unadulterated pursuit of the debtor's interest. And the comment from Justice Kagan in the case I'm thinking of was very similar. So that's always something to watch. Nothing much in the concurrence from Justices Sotomayor and Jackson. They just wanted to emphasize that this case did not involve fraud by a person that had no agency or partnership relationship to the debtor. So
based on state law, so much bankruptcy law is ultimately. You talk about the debtor-friendly. I always remember something Judge Eastbrook wrote one time, not in a bankruptcy decision, but he was talking about somebody who was relying on a liberal rule of construction. He said, to say that it is to be liberally construed is to give a direction and not a roadmap. It doesn't tell you how to end up. It tells you which way to go. I think it's very similar in that respect. The next case that came down, Justice Barrett, having served her time writing opinions, is now replaced by Justice Jackson for the next two, is the MOAC case, which we also talked about last year, MOAC being the Mall of America. This is a case in bankruptcy court in New York, but it involves some commercial property in Minnesota. Basically, what happened was Sears, when it was going under, got the bankruptcy court to approve its sale of a substantial portion of its assets to an entity put together to buy and hold its real estate assets. Of course, the question here was, what is the effect of Section 363M, the reversal or modification on appeal of an authorization under 363B or C? The sale of lease of property doesn't affect the validity of a sale or lease under such authorization to an entity that purchased or leased such property in good faith, whether or not it knew the pendency of the appeal, unless the authorization and sale were stayed pending appeal. So, you know, they had a bunch of properties. They got authorization in general, not to sell or lease, but at least to come back and present proposed sales or leases for approval in the future. So months after the sale closed, Sears sought and obtained, over Mall of America's objection, the bankruptcy court's approval to assign this mall lease to Transform, the artificial entity prepared for that purpose. Mall of America appealed and sought a stay pending appeal out of concern that Transform might argue on appeal that 363M precluded appellate review of the order. And at the stay hearing, this we talked about this last time, Transform told the bankruptcy court 363M doesn't apply to this order or the appeal because it arose from an assignment request under 365, and agreed that it would not raise a 363M argument on appeal. The bankruptcy court, regardless of, not surprisingly, relied on these statements in denying the stay request. So after a full briefing on the merits of the appeal, the district court ruled in Mall of America's favor, holding that, you know, this didn't satisfy the adequate assurance of future performance provisions for mall leases, whatever the technical term for those is. At that point, the Transform, the entity that had acquired these rights, changed course, wrote a petition for rehearing, a motion for rehearing in the district court, arguing for the first time that 363M did apply, that it was a jurisdictional statute, not subject to waiver, that it deprived the district court of jurisdiction to hear the appeal. The district court said that it was appalled, a lot of good that did Mall of America, by the conduct, but ruled with deep regret that Second Circuit authority deprived it of jurisdiction. The Second Circuit agreed and issued a stay pending appeal to the Supreme Court. 360, you know, this is part of, as we hear from the Supreme Court when it finally decided and reversed the Ninth Circuit, that the Supreme Court has been on a search and destroy mission for the last several years, not only in bankruptcy court, but generally, to get rid of provisions in procedure provisions that have been interpreted as jurisdictional. Late filing of something is jurisdictional. You can't do anything about it. And as a matter of fact, went through the beginning of Justice Jackson's opinion, a number of cases going back several years, looking at some of these in here, Fort Bend case, Kwai Fun Wong, these are not bankruptcy cases. They're preconditions to suit, like exhaustion requirements. Henderson versus Shinseki, which had to do with when you can file a claim for veterans benefits, Hamer versus the Neighborhood Housing Services out of the Seventh Circuit, Beckler versus Commissioner, a tax case. And she says, you know, that isn't really the way we want to treat these things. And the problem with it is that jurisdiction is too inflexible. It carries with it unique and sometimes severe consequences. An unmet jurisdictional precondition deprives courts of power to hear the case, and jurisdictional rules are impervious to excuses like waiver or forfeiture. So courts must also raise and enforce them sua sponte. So it matters whether they're jurisdictional or non-jurisdictional. And in light of that belated invocation of 363M by the Transform, the district court said if ever there were an appropriate situation for the application of judicial estoppel, this would be it. But not even such egregious conduct by a litigant, the Supreme Court says, could permit the application of judicial estoppel as against the jurisdictional rule. So it goes through and says, well, we're only going to apply, say a rule is jurisdictional, if the authority that creates it, often Congress, sometimes the court's rules, is clear, plain, that it is intended to be jurisdictional. And she proceeds to explain that this one ain't, and therefore reverses the Second Circuit unanimously and sends it back with the expectation that that in further proceedings the lower courts would find as they did that this reliance on 363M had been forfeited, waived, forfeited, whatever. Judge Wood would tell us it's important, which is which. I never forget, or Justice Abrahamson used to get all worked up about that too, whether it was forfeited or waived. Either way, if you're on the short end of the stick, you lose. So
result is the same.
Result is the same.
A couple of comments on it. To Tom's point about the cases involving or question whether something is jurisdictional. I found it interesting that Justice Jackson said that the Transform can't rely on pre-code rules or cases because they predate the court's effort to, quote, bring some discipline to the use of the term jurisdictional.
To their own use, yes, of the term jurisdictional. Yeah. Seriously, these exactly. Supreme Court cases often, and they just say, we're not going to do that anymore.
Yep. So. And then the last thing I'll say about that is,
say 1978 was before 1987.
Right. Yeah, just like the 11th Amendment was before the 14th.
Right? But in this case, like all that, the code was passed before Justice Scalia was on it.
The other thing that I'll say about it is, if you were here last year, you may remember we talked a little bit about this case was argued by Eric Brunstad of the Deckard firm, and he had
he doesn't do very well up there.
He really whipped the court kind of into a frenzy, leaving several of the justices to ask whether he had anything to say about the question that was actually presented. One of his big arguments was that the appeal was moot because he said, well, once the property leaves the race leaves the estate, the court no longer has
out
any
of the estate,
out of the state. The court no longer has any jurisdiction over it. I found it interesting how Justice Jackson dealt with that. She said that the court can't say that no relief remains legally available, and they said she said, well, we're not going to go into the complex depths of the code to try to assure itself that there is no relief available. And then in a footnote, there's this sentence, which I found very interesting. We need not take a definitive position on the correct resolution of Transform's elaborate mootness argument to be confident that MOAC's disagreement is not frivolous. which...
Go away, boy, don't bother me.
Yeah, it seems like they just sort of kicked it out. In any event...
like the flambeau?
Yeah, the next case, Tom, if you want to grab this. This is another clear statement case.
Yeah, this is one that came, had its whole history in the U.S. Supreme Court after our last November presentation here. The granting of cert, the briefing, the argument, the decision all got done by June. Again, I think they were filling it up. Interesting, starting with case name, it's Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians versus Coughlin. It was Coughlin. Well, Coughlin is a Chapter 13 debtor in Massachusetts. So what are the Lac des Flambeaux doing litigating with him in the District of Massachusetts and the First Circuit? Well, they have they make loans. They make payday loans. One of their businesses, one of the commercial businesses of the tribe, which of course is located in Minnesota and Wisconsin. When Mr. Coughlin went into Chapter 13 and the automatic stay came into effect and notice went out, they ignored it. They kept trying to collect the debt vigorously on the ground that they were sovereignly immune, that they were a unit of government, they were a tribe, and they were immune from being affected by the automatic stay, among other things. And the question is, a clear statement rule, because this is what the court has said, whether the bankruptcy code, this is the issue, expresses unequivocally Congress's intent to abrogate the unquestioned sovereign immunity of Indian tribes. And two provisions were obviously 106A, notwithstanding an assertion of sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity is abrogated as to a governmental unit, the extent set forth in this section, including the automatic stay. And then also the definitional 101, 101 sub 27, what is a governmental unit? Well, it seems to me like it's pretty much everything. The United States, a state, commonwealth, a district, a territory, a municipality, a foreign state, a department, agency, or instrumentality of the United States, a state, a commonwealth, a district, a territory, a municipality, or a foreign state, or other foreign or domestic government. Don't say anything about Indian tribes. So this was enough for Justice Gorsuch, who has been known to favor Indian tribes, to say, well, okay, they weren't covered. But the other eight thought differently. And Justice Jackson says, you know, what the hell? This is about everything we can think of. She said, I like some of these phrases too. Congress has to make its intent unmistakably clear anytime it abolishes, abrogates sovereign immunity. But the definition of governmental unit exudes comprehensiveness. The catch-all phrase, other foreign or domestic governments, expresses all-inclusiveness. I argue with that. So Congress unmistakably intended to cover all governments, whatever their location, nature, or type. Tribes undeniably fit that description because they're governments. The court doesn't decide whether tribes qualify as the domestic governments. It doesn't have to because it's governments, domestic or foreign. And then goes through why the policy choices in the bankruptcy code support the conclusion. Again, now here are the fresh starts coming in for the debtors' benefit. The automatic stay provisions support that goal. And there's a lot out there that governmental entities can do, but they can't violate the automatic stay. The court's conclusion is not changed because the statute doesn't specifically mention tribes. As long as Congress speaks unequivocally, it passes the clear statement test, regardless of whether it articulated its intent in the most straightforward way. Congress has specifically referred to tribes in other statutes, doesn't foreclose it from using different language to accomplish the same goal in other statutory contexts. So anyway, that's that.
So it stands for the proposition that a statement can be unmistakably clear, right, even though you can readily think of a clearer statement.
Right.
Yeah.
I would hope that would be the rule. Otherwise, who could write a statute? They're not that smart.
Oops, we forgot about Indian tribes. Oops.
Justice Thomas's concurring opinion, although I think he joined the court's opinion, was interesting. Carrying out one of his issues, he says, to the extent that tribes possess sovereign immunity at all, the immunity doesn't extend to suits arising out of the tribe's commercial activities conducted beyond its territory. And because the stay enforcement motion arose from the petitioner's off-reservation commercial conduct, the petitioners would lack sovereign immunity regardless of 106. So, and then he says, and the court should simply abandon its judicially created tribal sovereign immunity doctrine.
They used to try to make that argument as to states, right? And then right. The Supreme Court said, states.
What was that? Florida? That was an Indian tribe case, too.
No, that was state of Virginia versus somebody. Okay. So Supreme Court over the Constitution overrides all that. Forget about the 11th Amendment.
Oh, it's in the plan.
Bankruptcy power overrides the 11th Amendment. Don't worry about
it. In the plan of the convention.
Right.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Anyway.
Frank?
Okay. So that brings us to cases that are set for argument. This Purdue Pharma case is set for argument on December 4th, so it's right around the corner. It's probably going to be a long argument, I would guess, but
they don't have a limit on them anymore. The argument's gone as long as the court feels like listening.
It's going to be like the 19th century again, where you got two days of argument. Daniel Webster.
The only difference being in those days, there weren't briefs, and judges hadn't read briefs, so they sat there and learned about the case for the first time, and the ladies of Washington would come in their bonnets and sit in the back room and be entertained by it and go out and have picnic lunches. And they didn't have law clerks, that's a blessing, right? Anyway,
I don't think they'd do it that way.
No.
So December 4th, if you're interested, I'm sure it'll be
either or be square,
a good, lively debate. So, you've probably heard about this in the news. The case arises from the Chapter 11 cases of Purdue Pharma and its affiliates. Of course, the manufacturer of OxyContin has been sued.
How many times?
Many, many times for lots of money.
Trillions, right?
The estimate was at the time that the stay was imposed almost 3,000 actions against the debtors were stayed and over 400 actions against the Sackler family alone, comprised of demands that exceeded $40 trillion.
They just pay it and be done with it.
A lot of money. I want to say the number of Americans that have died in the opioid epidemic is over 250,000 people at this point. So there are a lot of people who care about it. And obviously a lot of litigation, a lot of money involved.
It comes down to a pretty simple question, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. Third-party releases, which have become quite popular, at least in other jurisdictions. I don't know, judges, have you, Mike, have you had any third-party release requests and plans?
Well, I don't know that you should call it that.
Okay.
Yeah. From time to time, there's language sometimes objected to, sometimes.
Okay. All right.
Nothing, you know, no case like this, but.
Yep.
So there is no case like this, right? And if there were, it wouldn't be filed in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. You can bet on it.
So, some interesting background. It's alleged that the Sackler family started to figure out that at some point this could come back, could come home to roost, and they started pulling large amounts of money out of the company and putting them into Sackler family trusts. The allegation is that some $11 billion in total was pulled out of the company and put into these family trusts, a lot of times spendthrift trusts or other vehicles that
debtor protection devices.
Yeah, can be used to avoid creditors. The plan was confirmed by the bankruptcy court.
Southern District of New York.
Yep. And it sets up trusts. It takes insurance rights and passes them. In other words, the insurance companies get to keep their rights. SACRs agreed to contribute to the plan some $4.3 billion that would fund these trusts.
Is that a substantial amount? That seems to be the test of those who think these are okay, right?
Right, right. The idea that it has to be a substantial contribution in order to in exchange for the release that's being given. And so in exchange here, of course, the Sackler family and the associated non-debtors, without the consent of all the affected claimants, would receive complete releases. And apparently that affects hundreds of parties, as the U.S. trustee stated, potentially thousands of non-debtors, including all sorts of members of the Sackler family. And the release covers any civil claim of any kind or character, expressly includes claims for fraud and willful misconduct, which is a point that is thrown about in a lot of the briefs because litigants are noting that even if the Sacklers had filed bankruptcy individually, and they did not, that they would not be able to discharge claims of that character on their own. It did not require consent of the claimants, so there was no sort of opt-in, opt-out clause.
But the claimants approved the plan.
Yes.
Right? Overwhelmingly, I think.
Yeah, they did. And there were a United States trustee opposed it,
sure.
8 states, District of Columbia, some Canadian creditors, and some of the individual claimants, they objected to the release, but as I mentioned, the bankruptcy court did confirm the plan and the Sackler release. The district court vacated the confirmation order containing the release, concluding that the bankruptcy code does not authorize courts to extinguish without consent direct claims held by non-debtors against other non-debtors. It is important to recognize that that's what we're talking about here when we use the phrase third-party releases. Judge Helfinger may not prefer that term, but it is claims by non-debtors against non-debtors, not to be confused with other releases or exculpation clauses that can be found in plans of reorganization that actually do involve the debtor or its professionals. So Purdue had relied on general code provisions to support its third-party release. I don't think I reproduced them in the materials, but section 101.5, yeah, which you're all familiar with.
We've been hanging a lot on 105 for a long time, not usually with great success.
And then also 1126, 1123b6, I think. Yeah, so a plan may provide for or may include any other appropriate provision not inconsistent with the applicable provisions of this title.
And essentially, there's clear language.
Yeah, essentially, the argument I think is that, a quote unquote third party release, I'm going to put it in quotes from now on, is not
forbidden.
It's not forbidden
expressly.
Expressly,
and therefore it must be included.
Yep, it's not inconsistent, and you can put it into a plan. So the district court rejected that argument, finding that that's an awful lot to put into 105A and 1123B6. Interestingly, while the appeals were pending in the Court of Appeals, the 8 objecting states in the District of Columbia reached an agreement with the debtors and the Sacklers. And so the Sacklers agreed to put another $1.75 billion into the trust.
They squeezed hard enough the first time, did they?
Yeah, yeah. In exchange, those parties agreed not to, essentially not to oppose anything anymore. So at the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, they had a divided panel. And they held first that the bankruptcy court did have subject matter jurisdiction over third party direct claims against non-debtors, because it's likely that the resolution of the released claims would directly impact the race. That part was interesting to me, and I noticed that it was not the jurisdiction argument was not present in a significant way in the briefs, from what I could tell. And so it almost seems like parties had largely agreed that the resolution of these release claims can directly impact the race, and therefore there is jurisdiction in the lower courts. From what I've seen over the years, that's been a really primary argument, is that it creates jurisdictional problems for a bankruptcy court to try to approve a plan that includes these kinds of releases. And the court pointed out that the third party claims are very similar to the estate's claims against the Sacklers. So we have, it looks like the estate is going to be affected by the treatment of these claims, and it's possible that some of the released parties could seek indemnification from the debtors based on the released claims. So you have
a question, sorry.
Yeah.
So when you talk about claimants, does the set of claimants include persons who did not file claims?
You mean the claimants that are the subject of the releases?
It's a release of claims that the claimants would have against non-debtors, right? Did all the claimants file claims, or are there claimants who would be subject to this that didn't file claims?
Well, you know that. I mean, it's impossible that it wouldn't be. Right. Impossible that you would ever get all the claims.
You could do it as some kind of class basis, maybe. Yeah. Question of whether you can have a class claim, which is another whole different issue. Yeah. But that's the potential. I mean, right. I presume, without really knowing, that I could see where someone or other courts maybe have had jurisdictional concerns about that.
Yep.
Whereas you might not if
they might actually change the jurisdictional came to the court.
Analysis, at least.
And the Court of Appeals also noted that the claims encompassed by the release are non-core under Stern versus Marshall, and so it is the district court rather than the bankruptcy court that would have to enter that final order approving any plan. Court of Appeals held that those two provisions working together, 105A and 1123B6, authorize court sitting in bankruptcy to approve non-consensual third-party releases. The majority interpreted 1123B6 to permit a bankruptcy court to take any action not expressly forbidden by the code, and because the code doesn't expressly prohibit the approval of non-consensual third-party releases, the releases are authorized. They did away with the arguments on due process and notice, finding that the debtors had done everything they needed to do there. And then they do talk about these tests that a lot of courts...
Seven-pronged tests.
Yeah, these seven-part tests that a lot of courts have followed in bankruptcy, and they found that the Sackler release had sort of satisfied that. Judge Wesley was the one who issued a concurring opinion. He sort of reluctantly went along with this.
Based on Second Circuit precedent.
Right, right. But he did
that jurisdictional precedent.
Right, that other Second Circuit precedent got shot down in flames.
But he did express a lot of skepticism about the reasoning. He found it to be without any basis in the code. He said the majority erred by inferring a power that is nothing short of extraordinary from what is effectively silence in Section 1123B6. And concluded that the residual equitable authority that's in these two sections is authority only to modify creditor-debtor relationships. Mm-hmm. And the plan has been put on stay in August. The Supreme Court issued a stay, even though the Second Circuit
denied it. But the fact the Supreme Court issued a stay, pretty clear they were going to take it up. And I think it probably suggests that they may be in trouble. That's interesting. This issue has been around And I used to do a lot more bankruptcy than I do now, both for debtors and creditors. We would do this. I mean, you sort of have to. It makes people happy and it makes the plan work. But I think we always kind of wondered whether what we were doing was permissible. And if you got pushed back, you hope you didn't get pushed back. And if you push back a little bit, maybe give them a little something to go away. But
another billion or so.
Another billion or so. But, you know, it's always been iffy. Do you not agree, Frank? I mean, it's kind of wonder. It doesn't really, it's a pretty thin soup, 105.
It's very thin, yeah.
And what would Judge Eisenberg's favorite, the rule of necessity, right?
to me, what it really reflects is that Congress needs to be a little quicker on acting on some of these things. You've got a provision in there that deals specifically with asbestos related right. claims. And they just, despite the fact that these cases have been going on for years and years and years, and it involves massive amounts of money, lots of people, cases that affect the nation, they're just not, not acting. They're not choosing to offer any more clarity in the code as to whether these are permissible in a broader sense.
I can sort of see that, though. You know, this would be a hell of a move if applied generally, right?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, people who don't put themselves under the gun or take the risks of going into bankruptcy can buy their way out of trouble. And the statute really doesn't say you can do it.
Right.
So, I mean, you can see asbestos was a problem. You had to have a solution. So Congress passes a solution. It only applies to asbestos.
Right.
Maybe someday they'll get one that only applies to OxyContin, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah. The OxyContin lobby.
Right. There's one out there, believe me.
I mean, just a last point or two, just to give you an idea of how many people this affects. That you know, as I mentioned, the amicus briefs, there's more than 20 of them that were filed. You've got a couple from the Boy Scouts of America, one from the Boy Scouts of America, one from the ad hoc group of local councils. You even had one that I didn't mention in here, which is from the, the Conference of Bishops.
No doubt. What do they want?
Well, they support third-party releases.
Why would
right?
they do that?
Because of all the, just like the case we had here in Milwaukee, where the parishes ended up getting releases.
My clients.
Yep, work that Tom did. I did it for a little bit when we were together. So you have not only a lot of people who are affected by this, outright, but all these other cases in different contexts where people are saying, whatever you do, just don't screw up our plan. It's pretty remarkable. So by far, I think the most significant case at the Supreme Court this year.
All that history is really... makes one point, which is the importance of principles of preclusion. Once the judgment confirming the plan is entered and it's final, don't go back and raise this again. It's done. And so it sort of corrects itself if you can get somebody to approve the plan, or you can, usually these are because there's agreement or there's no opposition and we all want to get it over with. But that's a lot to put on
judicata. So next we got a couple of cases, Tom, where the petitions right. were just granted.
Yeah, petitions just granted. John, again, this is coming back to something we've talked about in this session before, the John Q. Hammonds case out of the Tenth Circuit. It's the aftermath of Siegel versus
Fitzgerald.
Remember a few years ago, we talked about this and we talked about it before it went to the Supreme Court. We predicted what we thought was going to happen and it did. The Supreme Court finally bit the bullet and decided that the mess that Hal Heflin and who was the other, Sam Irwin put together, so that all the states in the United States, all 48 except Alabama and North Carolina were under the U.S. trustee system. They got their own system, do it their way. And guess what? I mean, the U.S. change came to the fee system back in 2016 or so, and the fees in Chapter 11 were jacked up in the U.S. trustee districts, but not in the two, Alabama and North Carolina. And eventually, after ducking it, the 10th Circuit said that's unconstitutional. It violates the Bankruptcy Uniformity Clause in the Constitution. And the Supreme Court, just what, a year ago, in Siegel versus Fitzgerald, said, yeah, it is. Now we'll send this case back to the 10th Circuit to figure out what to do. So that's the case that the Supreme Court has granted cert on. The 10th Circuit basically said, you know what, for the plaintiff who brought the, or the debtor who brought the case that had to pay too much, get it back, give it back. The question is, do you give it back, or do you say that, well, Congress kind of fixed this prospectively so it won't happen again, and that's enough, don't worry about it, or do you make the North Carolina and Alabama people retroactively pay fees? Good luck finding them, right? And the 10th Circuit issued an opinion basically reinstating once the Supreme Court said, consider this further. Yeah, we told you what we thought a couple of years ago. Here's what we are. We say the same thing. I give it back. So that's what the Supreme Court has taken up on that issue.
Is there a split?
No, there's no split. This is the case the Supreme Court had.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So what was the grounds for granting cert? What did the cert petition say was the grounds for?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court, having sent it back to say fix it.
They send a lot of stuff back.
Well, this was the case, you know, and it said explicitly, we're not going to try to figure that out right now. We'll see what the lower court says. So they're going to see what the lower court said. I'm not surprised. Anyway.
Seeing it through to the end, that was the reason for granting it.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
What was the reason for that?
Seeing it through to the end. You know, they want.
And then they've granted review on something called the truck exchange, truck insurance exchange. And I'll be damned if I can even understand what this is about. And by the way, briefs haven't been filed, so it's kind of hard to figure it out. Sometimes you see they've granted cert without really knowing what the case is about. This arises out of, as Frank's outline makes clear on whatever that is toward the end, page 25 or thereabouts, whether an insurer with financial responsibility for a bankruptcy claim is a party in interest that may object to a reorganization plan under Chapter 11. And apparently this plan came up from somewhere in the Fourth Circuit, North Carolina, I think. Reorganization plan established a trust for certain current and future asbestos. I think we solved all the asbestos, personal injury liabilities. And it treats the holders of insured and uninsured asbestos personal injury claims differently. Insured claims would be brought against the insurance company, subject to the insurer's pre-existing rights, but uninsured claims would be submitted directly to the trust. And only the persons bringing uninsured claims would be required to provide disclosures to ensure that the trust paid only valid non-duplicative claims. So this trust and truck insurance exchange says it's a party in interest. It's entitled to raise and be heard on the issue. Bankruptcy court said they weren't a party in interest. The district court affirmed. The Court of Appeals affirmed. The Supreme Court's granted review. So we'll see about it. I don't know.
Yeah, and interesting that the party in interest concept is also an issue in the Purdue Pharma case, because the parties have asserted that the United States trustee does not have standing. They're not a party in interest that can try to blow up this their plan and the third party releases.
They're the United States government.
Effectively saying, you know, you're an interloper. I believe they used that word at one point. And get out of the way. Everybody's agreed to this. You know, you're just the U.S. trustee.
And so for truck insurance exchange, right, the question is the interpretation of 1109B, the right to be heard on the
channel, right?
Yep.
Right.
Which says the debtor, and including, uses the word including, which the code says is non-limiting.
Right.
Yeah. So another party and interest issue. And then the last one we've got is as I mentioned, a case that actually both Tom and I were involved in. So was Judge Blize before she took the bench. We're all on our hands in this one in some way. I'm no longer involved. Tom still is. So I'll talk about it. Tom
and Rachel is no longer involved.
She's no longer involved, to be clear. Thank you.
Haven't been for a long time.
Quite an interesting case, really, because of the fraud that is at the core of it. Engstrom was a company that provided staffing services of all places to nuclear power plants. So they had a very specific group of employees with very particular skills, and that was their specialty, putting people at nuclear power plants. And I think it had to do with the way that the money would flow in their business. They ended up having to factor their invoices. So they contracted with a company called LSQ Funding. And they did quite a bit of it. In fact, by January of 2020, Engstrom was indebted to LSQ in an amount that exceeded $10 million. The Chapter 7 trustee, now Doug Mann, the case was originally filed as Chapter 11 and then converted, alleged that Engstrom and its CEO were engaged in a massive fraud, that essentially what the CEO had done was create phony accounts to induce LSQ to factor against what were really bogus invoices, essentially a Ponzi scheme that created the appearance of a really flourishing business. And I will say, as an aside, that the fraud was either so sophisticated or so unsophisticated that it got to the point that the owner of the business, Engstrom, to pretend that she was the account debtor, allegedly used a voice alteration machine when the other party, in this case Millennium, tried to do some due diligence and confirm that these were true accounts.
Can't
and
make
it was
this stuff up,
it folks. Was really her on the phone with a voice alteration machine.
So they say.
So Millennium asserted that LSQ had caught on to the fraud and terminated its agreement with Engstrom in January 2020. And then only weeks before Engstrom filed for bankruptcy protection, Engstrom's CEO orchestrated a payoff agreement between LSQ and a new lender, Millennium. Pays Engstrom's debt to LSQ. LSQ releases its security interest in Engstrom's accounts so that the accounts could then be pledged to Millennium. The transaction essentially swapped Millennium for LSQ as the secured creditor. LSQ was paid in full. Importantly, I don't think there's any dispute that the money never really entered the debtor's hands. So the money essentially just passed from one creditor to another. Millennium, within weeks, as I recall, quickly discovered the fraud. And within 3 months after that, Engstrom filed for bankruptcy protection. So the trustee sues LSQ to avoid this payoff transaction as a preferential or fraudulent transfer.
Well, sir, it was the first sues to just to set it aside as a preference.
Preference. And then was fraudulent transfer added?
Yeah.
Okay.
548 and then 544B.
Right. So the trustee alleged that the accounts Millennium purchased were worthless and that LSQ conspired with Engstrom to leave Millennium with the phony accounts and keep the Ponzi scheme running. Bankruptcy court entered summary judgment for LSQ, holding the payoff was not avoidable because it didn't qualify as a transfer of an interest of the debtor in property. One of the key threshold requirements for a preference or a fraudulent transfer.
It's interesting because it has always been a threshold requirement for preference, but it has only been for fraudulent transfer since 1978 when Congress put it into the statute.
So that same language appears in both 547 and 548 now. And the bankruptcy court applied it as the earmarking doctrine. concluding that the payoff funds from Millennium were earmarked for LSQ. Engstrom never had control of the funds, and therefore it was not an interest of the debtor in property. The district court affirmed, and the bankruptcy opinion, I believe, was Judge Perhatch, right? Yes, and it was your case. I remember that during the pandemic. We had lots of plastic shields up in the courtroom. So the Seventh Circuit issued its opinion recently, opinion by Judge St. Eve. I found it interesting. They said, we don't have to focus on this earmarking doctrine. All we're going to do is interpret the statute and the text of the code and the application precedent resolve the case. The purpose of the preference for fraudulent transfer provisions, they held, is to preserve property includable within the bankruptcy estate. In other words, the property that's available for distribution to creditors. The court asked whether the debtor can exercise control over the funds that are transferred and whether the transfer diminishes property of the estate, the goal being to determine whether the transfer takes something from the pool of assets that would otherwise have gone to creditors. And the court gets into this analysis of who controls disposition of the funds. Did you designate where the money was going to go? And they found that while the debtor may have sort of chosen to pay these funds to LSQ, that it really didn't have the ultimate ability to determine the disposition of the funds. So it wasn't a transfer of an interest in property. They have a petition for a writ of certiorari recently within the last month. Right. Tom's got a brief due in the next week. Couple of weeks. And the most interesting thing that I found about it, just taking a quick look at their petition brief, is this idea that the Seventh Circuit focused on whether there's a diminution or harm to the estate. And it really does not, it's not in the statute. So it'll be interesting to see, you know.
But the case law going back a long time on earmarking focuses on that.
It does, yeah. Yeah, I think you can go back to the cases under the Act.
Right.
That talk about that too. So it'll be interesting to see. I would guess they wouldn't take it, but the petitioner does claim that there's a circuit split.
From your mouth to God's ear.
Yeah, yeah. They claim that there's a circuit split that between the second and fourth, where they claim that those circuits have held that transfers made with actual intent to hinder, delay, or defraud are avoidable without need to establish economic harm to the estate. And they claim that's in conflict with the law in the 7th and 11th circuits.
See, comme ça.
Thank you. Any questions? Any question from remote viewers? We'll see if we can entertain those. Guess not.
Would those be remote questions?
They might be. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.